We're going to continue our series in the Sermon on the Mount. We're going to listen to Jesus teach us what it looks like to follow him, what it means to be his disciple. And we are about halfway in our series, and we've looked at a lot of ways and a lot of areas where we are called to be faithful stewards of what we have, what it means to follow him, our time, our words, our relationships, our marriages. And now we're going to be looking at our possessions and what it means to bring our possessions and put them under the lordship of Jesus as disciples. And so I want us to hear Jesus preach on this. If you have a Bible, you can turn with me to Matthew 6, and we'll be reading verse 19 to 24. Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where moth and rust do not destroy and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there is your heart will also be. The eye is the lamp of the body. If your eyes are healthy, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eyes are unhealthy, your whole body will be full of darkness. And if the light within you is darkness, how great is that darkness? No one can serve two masters. Either will you hate the one and love the other, or you will be devoted to one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money. Now, I want to begin with a story about a man named Bill Watterson. Does anyone know who Bill Watterson is? If you are a child of the 80s and 90s, you will know his masterful works of art. You know what they are? Calvin and Hobbes, the world's greatest comic strip, in my opinion. Few comic strips are as clever and as funny and as deep as Calvin and Hobbes, where you enter into the experience of this little boy and his little tiger doll and his adventures and his reflections on the existence of life, etc. If you haven't read Calvin and Hobbes, get yourself Calvin and Hobbes. They're as good for adults as they are for kids. Now, the creative cartoonist behind it, Bill Watterson, was an incredibly reclusive man. In fact, very few photos exist of him. Very little is known about him. He said no to interviews and all the media attention, even at the height of his popularity. And we learn later about Bill Watterson that for the first 5 years of his career, leading up to his pinnacle of popularity, he was in a five-year battle with his bosses, with his syndicate. Here's what the battle was over. When he became popular, his bosses realized they could make a lot of money off Calvin and Hobbes if they commodified and monetized Calvin and Hobbes and made figurines and backpacks and all sorts of merchandise like you see of Frozen, for example, which took over North America. And Bill Watterson looked at this and they just wanted him to sign off and say, go for it and merchandise. And he said, absolutely not. I will not commodify these characters. And this ensued a massive battle where it came to the point where Watterson was going to say, you know what? I quit. And I want to hear you hear what Watterson himself describes this tension to be. He writes, to put the problem simply, trainloads of money were at stake. Millions and millions of dollars could be made with just a few signatures. Now, most cartoonists would be eager to do this for exposure and wealth and the prestige that licensing offers. And when cartoonists fight with their syndicates, it's almost always to make more money, not less. After 5 years, I was prepared to quit. If I could not control what Calvin and Hobbes stood for, the strip was worthless to me. At this point, the syndicates agreed to renegotiate my contract. The exploitation rights were returned to me, and I will not license Calvin and Hobbes. Now, any merchandise you have ever seen of Calvin and Hobbes is illegal. Did you know that? And that includes, the only merchandise I ever see is the stickers on the back of trucks where Calvin's peeing on other trucks. That, too, is illegal. It was so significant, this conflict, that the syndicates actually had advertisers send boxes of little figurines, prototypes of Calvin and Hobbes, to Watterson's house so he could look at these prototypes and be won over by how cute they were. And you know what he did? This is a true story. He took those little figurines, he lit them on fire, and he sent their charred remains right back to the advertisers. This guy was savage. Now, here's my question about Bill Watterson for you. How does this story sit with you? When you hear of Watterson's fight with his syndicate, does he inspire you or does he frustrate you? Do you look at his actions as admirable, right down to the charred remains of these little figurines? Or do you see him as a very foolish man who watched millions of dollars go up in smoke? Or let me frame the question differently. Could you have done what Bill Watterson did there? Could you have let the pen stay on the table and said no to all the money and choose a life of relative simplicity and obscurity over all the fame and the money that advertising merchandise would have brought you? Now, I don't know that much about Bill Watterson. Nobody does. I don't even know what he believed or all the reasons behind this, but it seems to me that he counted the cost of the wealth and all the popularity that this merchandising would make, and he said, I don't want to pay the price. Oh, that Christians would have that kind of discernment. Now, it seems to me that what Jesus says in this small part of the Sermon on the Mount may very well be the most challenging for us to hear, not because of how radical Jesus is being, but because of where you and I live. I don't think I need to convince anyone in this room that Canada is one of the wealthiest countries in the world. Canada is one of the wealthiest countries throughout history. And as one person put it, that when you are born in Canada, you win, and I quote, the cosmic lottery. Because you are born to so much wealth and opportunity and possibility. Even the poor in Canada have been described to me as people from other countries as a very incredible opportunity. Even our poor have social networks and security and food, and they have opportunity and health care. That's unheard of in other countries and throughout history. But more to the point, even sociologists who have no interest in the Christian faith, they look at and describe Canadian culture as, quote, a consumer culture. Think about that. A defining word of Canadian and Western culture is consumer. And what they mean by that is not just that we consume things, but that we actually organize our whole culture around the buying of things, the making of money, retirement, toys, technology. We're organizing our cultural life around consumption. Does that make sense? It's not just a part of culture, it's the purpose that we're shaping our culture around. We are a consumer culture. Now here's the tension. I think most Canadian believers are way too comfortable swimming in consumer waters and feel way too at home, present company included. And I think if we're hearing Jesus right in this sermon, it's got to create a tension for disciples who are living in a consumer culture. You know, I feel like I set my sermon up well last week because I said that preachers are not supposed to make friends when they preach. It's not about being well-liked, and here I am preaching on money, and I think this is a hard sermon to preach. At least it is to myself. But Jesus is inviting us, and I'm going to say this very clearly as much away as I know how. He's inviting us to a life of choosing simplicity, choosing generosity, and choosing trust in God, which Sid will preach on next week, over and against consumption and excess and amassing treasures. So let's listen to Jesus. Before I read what he starts this sermon with, I want to read a bit of an extended quote about Jesus himself. Here's a very basic point that we don't want to overlook. Jesus was poor. The one that we model our lives after, the one that we follow as disciples, was poor. He lived in very simple ways. He chose a life of radical simplicity. Listen to what Scott McKnight, one scholar, writes about Jesus. Is it up on the screen? Do we have that? There it is. Thank you. Jesus lived in a dry, hot, and dusty world. What food he ate, he received from fishing and farming or by donations. The summers were long and filled with famine-causing heat. He lived on little. He lived on the generosity of others. He undoubtedly knew some hunger and thirst. He saw some homes every day where wealthier Jews and Romans had villas and plenty of food and entertainment. He knew what it was to have little and to dwell with those who had even less, while others around him basked in luxury and filled their mouths with delicacies. He embodied a carefree, trust in God kind of economic vision. He demanded simplicity because he lived it. He expected care for the poor because he experienced it. How does that sit with you? It's this King Jesus who chose poverty who says to all of us, do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but store up for yourselves treasures in heaven where moth and rust do not destroy and where thieves do not break in and steal. And what Jesus is doing here is he is commanding us. This is a command to not pursue excess, to not pursue the amassing of earthly treasures. And he gives practical reasons for this. He says, moth and rust and thieves, they take it, they destroy it. It's chasing after something that isn't really permanent. It can't really sustain you. You know, in the first century, moth and rust were serious concerns, and thieves were as well. And I think of those three, the only real concern we have here in Surrey is maybe thieves. But let me suggest that we live in the same level of insecurity and temporariness in these areas. We just don't realize it. Let me explain. The money we put in banks are subject to all the insecurity of the global markets. And 2009 reminded every North American person that that is an insecure thing to hold on to. The cars we buy, those shiny machines, in 15 years our kids will make fun of. Maybe even quicker. Those fancy homes we have, those age and sag. The clothes we have go out of style and wear out, unless, of course, it's the 80s and they come back in style, and I'm still stunned that I see teenagers going to school and they look like my brothers and I did when we were kids. I didn't think it was possible. The technology we buy slows down and goes out of date and needs to be replaced, and we feel the temporary nature of it. And I was struck just yesterday. I was at a funeral, and there's some people from our church at this funeral. A man named Fred Hurst passed away, and nothing was said about Fred's possessions. Nothing. It mattered not one bit at a funeral. And I think to myself, here we are in a culture that chases after possessions, forgetting every single day that when we die, that is the last thing that anyone will say about us. Now, I want to pause here, and I want to say a word to millennials my age and people who are younger. I have learned in the last number of years that there is critiques from my generation looking up at the boomers, and we say, those older people, they are so consumeristic. They've got the big houses, they've got the cars, they've got the cottages, and we don't. In part because we simply can't afford it. And we're not going that way. We critique that generation. I think, well, yeah, okay, we're not amassing treasures, those same kinds of earthly possessions, but we've just shifted those earthly treasures. They look a little bit different. They look like traveling to exotic places, eating fascinating foods, going and experiencing all these different cultures. And don't forget, they're all documented carefully. They're filtered on the perfect Instagram feed so our friends can see and like our very exciting life. That's a new kind of earthly treasure, and it has the same kind of power. And it is just as temporary as the big houses and the boats, etc. I was at a wedding not that long ago, and I was in line to find my seat in the ceremony, and there was this young woman in front of me, and I couldn't help but notice her because of how she was dressed, which is fairly provocatively, and she was also taking piles and piles of selfies. She was sitting there waiting in line, and, you know, this, and then all the poses, and then when she finally exhausted all the possible poses, I'm not joking, she handed the phone to her mother, who obliged very begrudgingly, who just stood there behind the phone, and she took about 20 to 30 more selfies. What are they called when your mother takes the phone? I don't know. Anyway, there she poses in all these places, moving around this area, and I thought to myself, man, what will become of her when her view of herself and her image is no longer that popular on social media? What will become of that treasure? And Jesus invites every single person who hears this sermon to ask the question, what do I treasure? He says, what you treasure, that's where your heart is. The things you value most deeply, that's where your heart is attached. So what do you treasure? When you drive home on the long commute from work, what's animating your imagination as you envision your future? When you're laying awake at night thinking about your life and where you want to be in 10, 20 years, what stuff is coming to mind? What are you imagining and desiring and wanting? Or as James K. Smith puts in his book, what vision of the good life are you pursuing? And does it look any different from your neighbors who are on the treadmill of consumption? Are you thinking about what's coming to mind? Jesus then turns to speak positively. And this is where we want to tune in. He says, but store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where moth and rust do not destroy and thieves do not break in and steal. Now here's my question. What does that even mean? When you think of storing for yourself treasures in heaven, what comes to mind? I had to really ask that question because I wasn't even sure what it meant this week. And there is a certain reading of this passage that says we need to store for ourselves treasures in heaven, and we need to not care about the material world, we need to not care about this earthly existence we have, but just sort of a non-material heavenly future in the sky. We need to be preoccupied with that. And I don't think that's what Jesus is trying to say. First of all, if you read the Gospels, Jesus is very concerned with the material world. All of his healing, all of his care, all of his caring for the vulnerable, the poor, and the casting out of demons, all that stuff is because he cares for the material world. So what does he mean? Store up for yourselves treasures in heaven. Well, I think there's a word that shows up throughout the Gospel of Matthew that helps us. Because Jesus describes heaven as the kingdom of heaven. He describes heaven as the kingdom, the rule of God, the reign of Jesus over the entire creation. And one writer says, disciples are the people who catch a glimpse of the kingdom, the rule of Jesus, the rule of God over our earth, and they are caught into that vision. And it changes how they do everything, as we've been looking throughout this sermon. How they speak, how they live, how they have marriage, how they do family, how they do their work, and how they now carry their possessions. So what is that vision of the kingdom of heaven? It's a glimpse of where God is taking the entire world. This might be new to some of you, let me explain what I mean. When Jesus enters into our reality, and he starts teaching, and he starts healing, and he starts doing all sorts of stuff, he is constantly giving us a glimpse of the way the world was in the beginning, and the way the world will be in the end when he returns. So when he heals the demon-possessed man, he casts out the demons, he's saying, people will be in the right state of mind. When he raises a sick girl from the dead, he declares powerfully, death has no power when I return in glory. When he calms the storm, he's saying, there will be no natural disasters in the new creation when my whole world is healed. When he cares for the sick people and forgives the prostitute and constantly is forgiving the sin of people who feel unforgivable, he's saying, that's the way the world's going to be. It's beautiful. If you don't know much about this, just read through the Gospel of Matthew and focus on the miracles and the power of Jesus and how all of that points to the way the world's going to be. It's beautiful and it's glorious. And disciples of Jesus are those who catch a glimpse of what that looks like and says and say to themselves, this is how we're going to begin to live now. When Jesus arrived, he didn't say that kingdom's just in the future. Through his death and resurrection, he says this kingdom is opened now. This is a way we can begin to live now. And followers of Jesus are constantly saying, okay, if this is the way the world's supposed to be, if justice and mercy and peace and grace are supposed to dominate the whole existence of a creation, I'm going to begin to live that now. And that means bringing our possessions under the lordship of Jesus and saying to him, your will be done, your kingdom come with my stuff as it is in heaven. Is that starting to make sense of what it means to store up our possessions in heaven? Catching a glimpse of the way the world will be, the way the world is under the rule of Jesus and saying, that's how we're going to live now. And I'll come back to that at the end. Now here's my question. How in the world do we step into this kind of vision? What are the practical things that we can do that will enable us to step off the consumption treadmill of our culture and live faithfully with our money and our stuff and our possessions? First thing I'm going to suggest is the practice of gratitude and thanksgiving. Here's why I say that. I think all of us, this pastor in particular, we have the propensity to think, well, I've worked. These are the things I have. These are the things I worked hard for. This is what I deserve. And somehow you buy into the easy lie that you own this stuff. And the practice of gratitude is saying, God, I thank you for my home. I thank you that I have a vehicle. I thank you for my health. I thank you for my family. And the practice of praying gratitude reminds you, you don't own anything. Think about that. Do you actually believe this? We have possessions, yes, but do we own anything? Do disciples of Jesus actually own anything? No. And the practice that grounds us in this truth is gratitude and thanksgiving. And it seems to me that more disciples of Jesus learn how to pray prayers of gratitude, the more open-handed they can live with all the stuff God's given them. He's a good father. He's generous. He gives us many things. And we turn that back to praise, and we turn it out to generosity. That's the second practice. Practicing generosity. Give stuff away. Tithe generously. Be able to lend stuff. And even if it gets a little bit wrecked, it's not going to wreck your life. Because these are just possessions to bless people with. Interestingly, in the part of this passage where it talks about the eye being the lamp of the body, there's so much debate over this passage, and I'm not going to get into that debate. But the two Greek words used for the healthy eye and the unhealthy eye are also Greek words used to describe being generous and being stingy. And the implication seems to be, from what I gather, that the person who is generous and sees needs and has compassion and gives is the one with the healthy eye that reflects the healthy inside, the light. And the stingy person who does not care about the needs around them and is selfish with their money and their possessions, they are the one who contains darkness. Practice generosity. Now, what does that look like? Now, I think for me anyway, it's easy to be possessive. Anyone else have that? When you have stuff, you sort of protect it. And it's also easy to be entitled, to think somehow you deserve everything you have, and you deserve a lot more than what you have. And I had a moment, what was it, 2 years ago, where I was paying for flights to visit family in Ontario, and I was griping and complaining about how much it costs. And then my father-in-law, who's not here this morning, he just said to me, you know, when we were your age, Dave, we never even thought about flying. We didn't have the money. He's like, you shouldn't think you should deserve to fly. And all of a sudden, I'm like, wow, I'm an entitled millennial. This is terrible. And all of a sudden, I was frustrated with Mike because he exposed my heart that I felt like I deserved those flights to visit my family. And you fill in your own idols, okay? That's mine. You fill in your own. But we have that possessiveness. And the reality is that the more stuff we have, the harder it is to detach our hearts from it. The more stuff we bring into our homes and into our lives, the easier it is for us to sort of, it holds us in our hearts, and we sort of begin to hoard these things as our possessions. And the practice that will guard us from that is generosity. Give it away. Give your money away. Give things that you might feel overly attached to away. The thing that you have a propensity to buy too much of away. And I'll do another confession here. When we went camping last year with family, we were talking about our weaknesses with money. This is a good conversation around the dinner table tonight, by the way. Where's your weakness with money? And I can easily criticize people who buy too much of one thing, but let me tell you where my weakness is most prominently felt. At the camping aisle in Canadian Tire. I'm just like, take it all. This is amazing. This lantern's better than my old lantern. And I realize we all have those weaknesses, and we need to know what those are and invite people to challenge us in those places so that those particular things do not have a hold on us and we don't become possessive and entitled and greedy. And even more radically, give those things away. Let people use those possessions. See if you can handle that and let it be detached from your heart. There's a family I know, it's a couple, and they have a 10-year-old daughter now. And for the last number of years, they have Sabbath, or their Sabbath is on Saturdays. Saturdays is their day off as a family. And what they do as a family, they have these practices where they say, on Saturday, we play together, we pray together, and we give stuff away together. And their daughter, who when she was already 4 or 5 years old, she was allowed to go around their house and grab anything and give that thing away. Yeah, I know what you're thinking. If they take this, I'd be so mad at my daughter. And so she would literally, and this is true, she would go to the neighbors and she would say, okay, today's Saturday, we give things away, here's this lamp, or whatever. And there were times where the parents would cringe, thinking to themselves, oh, we should definitely have hid that in our bedroom before we did this. But what a practice, not just for the girl, but for the parents. Can we part with this? What's she going to pick? And to top it off, she's on the autism spectrum, and they could never predict the thing that she was going to pick. Could we do that? Another family, let me spark your imagination, families. Another family at Christmas time, which is like the ultimate consumer holiday in the West, more stuff comes into the house than we know what to do with. And this one, two families I know of, they say to all their kids, and they say it themselves, more stuff leaves this house than comes into this house over Christmas. And if their kids have this many gifts coming in, they have to look around the rooms and look around their house and say, this is what I'm giving away to friends, to family, or donating to kids who don't have stuff like we do. And what I love about both of those stories is it doesn't just deal with the consumer problem in our own hearts as parents, but it's formation for our children. And I don't think I'm the only one who's not only concerned about my own heart and my own proclivity to possessiveness and entitlement, but also how are my kids growing up in an increasingly consumer world? How am I going to help disciple them to be generous and not have a hold in their heart for money and possessions? And it starts with the practices in our home. Third, we want to go beyond just giving stuff away. And this is where I felt personally challenged. Build relationships with those who are vulnerable and poor. Befriend people who are not above you in socioeconomic status, but below you. And there's so many reasons I could say on why. First of which, that's what Jesus did. You want to pattern your life after Jesus? Get to know the poor. Befriend them, live with them, care for them. They are image bearers. In our culture, the unspoken hierarchy is the people with the most money are the people you want to be with. No one talks about this. This is the reality. We all admire the wealthy. We admire what they've done in business. We want to be their friends and hopefully get their money. And in Jesus' economy, the poor matter just as much. The vulnerable matter just as much. And they are the friends and brothers and sisters in the kingdom. Can we do that? And here's one of the ways I've learned that it's helpful. It grounds you. What we do, generally, if we have friends who are all in the same socioeconomic category, we normalize our way of life and our wealth, and then we often compare to those who are wealthier than us, right? Look at our car, and we wish we had that person's car. And then in that category, whatever category they're in, they probably also upwardly compare. And then I wonder, what does Jeff Bezos do, right? Who does he compare to? But befriending and being in meaningful relationship with the vulnerable people, with poor people, grounds you. I'll give one example of that personally. A few years ago, Brittany and I had two Hondurans stay with us. They had never been in North America before. And they came to stay in our basement suite with us. And there's a piece of me that's like, oh, it's just this humble little home. And I had to teach them how to use the shower. I had to teach them how to turn on the oven. I had to show them that you could take a cup right out of the cupboard and you can put it under the tap, turn on the water, and drink it. And it's healthy and it's safe. And I have to admit to you, I was so ashamed of myself. Because often in my home, I think, oh, this is what we can renovate. This is what we can make more beautiful. This is what we can do. And these Hondurans, they look around the home and they're like, wow, two bathrooms. I was like, wow, I am on that treadmill of consumption. I'm on that treadmill of earthly possessions. And these two friends from Honduras helped me see my heart. And I didn't like what I saw. Build relationships with those on the margins. And I realize that's not easy for some of us to do, but that's coming right out of what Jesus is teaching. And those of you who serve at the Cloverdale Community Kitchen, you know what I'm talking about. Youth who serve in Mexico, you know what I'm talking about. Young adult team that's going to Colombia, you are going to know what I'm talking about in just a couple days. To summarize, in our story, the true story of the whole world, the biblical story, God owns it all. Cultivate that conviction. Because tomorrow morning when you go to work, the lie is that you deserve it. You deserve more. You're entitled to a life of consumption. And to that we say, God owns it all. And the practice that reminds of this is gratitude. In God's story, the true story, those who have possessions, they give it away joyfully, gladly to serve those who have need. Knowing that in the kingdom, when Jesus returns in glory, the poor will be cared for. The marginalized will be lifted up. Those who have need, those needs will be met. And believers, you and I, are those who know that future and decidedly, joyfully practice that now. Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth, but store up for yourselves treasures in heaven. Where your heart is, that's where your treasure is. In closing, let me just say, that if we learn how to do this, we will have a powerful witness in our culture. I'm very convinced that not only in our own church do we have many struggles with money and a lot of addiction to money and all the stuff that comes with it, but we live in a culture that doesn't even know another story. They don't know a different way of being with money, a different way of living with our possessions, the way of freedom. We're the people who are told in the scriptures that our possessions, our money, our wealth, that's not going to save us. That's not going to sustain us. That's not going to bring us the joy we are created to experience. And it's the church that says, that's found in Jesus. And when we bring all that we have underneath his lordship, we say it's all for him and for his kingdom. That's where the joy and the real life is discovered. And as we begin to live that, we tell a beautiful story where Jesus is at the center and his kingdom is coming through the work of Jesus, the church. Let's pray.